Welcome to the Business and Leadership Channel. My name is Michelle Boulay, and I'm so honored to be a sponsor here at this amazing conference because it's my passion to help you connect to your own inner leader and let that transform the businesses and relationships you create. I'm a life coach and healer and an internationally recognized award-winning dance artist. And dancing taught me to listen to my own inner voice and let that guide me to my success. A very common thing that happens for business owners, creatives, and leaders is that you're so close to your next goal or breakthrough and then you stop. Doubt kicks in, worry, procrastination, fear, overwhelm, which kill growth in your business and creative process. So I'm giving a talk here on Saturday, October 24th, where you'll learn tools so that you can show up with clarity and belief in yourself and your ideas, consistency to keep showing up, and the embodied and intellectual understanding to move you gracefully through the challenges you'll meet as you grow, as you go for your goals. If you can't make it live, pick up your phone now, go to Instagram or Facebook, find me, follow me, and DM me the word success, and I'll send you the free resource I'll be sharing at my presentation. It's also in the show notes. However, I do recommend you attend live here or at my main stage presentation to get the full scope of what I'll be sharing to help you realize your creative dreams. And now, please enjoy this next presentation.
Today, I have the pleasure to receive Alanis Morissette. So for people who don't know Alanis, she's a musician, singer, songwriter, and won 7 Grammy Awards. And in 2016, Alanis launched Conversation with Alanis Morissette, where she was covering a wide range of psychosocial topics extending from spirituality to developmentalism to art. You can see I'm French.
You can say it.
As well, I have the pleasure to receive Richard Schwartz. Richard Schwartz is the founder of Internal Family System, IFS, author and therapist. Dr. Schwartz developed IFS in response to clients' descriptions of various parts within themselves. So today, this is a special session as you will have a 60-minute conversation between Richard and Alanis, and then the participant will have the possibility to raise questions, Q&A, for 30 minutes. So welcome, Alanis and Richard. Up to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having us. Yeah. I just wanted to say hi and welcome everyone. It's an honor to be here and also to be with you, Richard, just to be talking about not only internal family systems, but as much parts talk as we can do. I remember having met Debbie Ford years ago, and I worked under her as a mentee with Debbie for probably about 7 years on and off. And when we first met, we hugged because we recognized that we were sort of diving into unique versions of Carl Jung's idea of the shadow and the idea of subpersonalities. And there's all these gorgeous names that have been used to describe different aspects of self within this multitudinous being that we are. And for years, I just kept calling it parts. And I made a necklace. I designed a necklace that just said all parts, you know, that guest house Rumi poem where every guest is to be welcomed. And so all of these themes were swimming around in my own life. To some degree, I was doing the work really deeply, and other times completely disassociated. Then I learned all about IFS, internal family systems, and Richard Schwartz, after having gone through a relatively difficult time postpartum. I've had 3 postpartum activities, as I call it. And in the throes of my second time experiencing it, I went to meet with Brian Robinson in Asheville, North Carolina, and had an intensive with him. And he introduced IFS to me. And I just remember my jaw dropping, saying, this is it. This is the work that I've been wanting to do. And it's so integrative based on what I've learned from the past and used for my own personal life in the past. And then Richard, you just have taken it to a whole other level of clarity and accessibility. And I'm here today to support that cause and also just focusing, of course, on the theme of how to bring the self or feel this felt sense of self in the body.
Right. So,
anyway, really happy to be here. Over to you, Richard.
Well, I'm so honored by your getting IFS so deeply and feel very connected just through all of our interactions. And before that, I was a huge fan of your music. So this has been fantastic. And as we're talking about parts, I'll just go into a little bit of an intro about IFS for a second so we can get everybody up to speed, and then we'll play with the embodiment theme. So I ran into parts not knowing anything about it back about almost 40 years ago as a therapist working with eating disorders, and clients started talking about these different parts that were driving them crazy inside. And it sounded like, first I got scared, it sounded like they had multiple personality disorder. Then I noticed I've got them too, and they're equally extreme inside of me. And then I got curious, and I come from a family therapy background. So I was really trying to understand not just each part individually, but how they related to each other and what kind of sequences would happen, just like I did in working with families. And in getting curious about that and having a couple clients who were extremely articulate about it, I learned, first of all, they aren't what they seem, that this critic we all have inside isn't just a parental introject, it's called, or internalized parental voice. But in fact, if you stop and just listen and open to it, you'll get to know that it's trying to protect you. It's trying to attack you to try and get you to work harder or be perfect, or it's trying to run you down so you don't take any risks. And as you get to know that, and you start asking more questions, you learn that it's protecting other very vulnerable parts, that it's afraid it'll get hurt if it doesn't do this job, for example. And that in some ways, it's like a child in a family who's been forced into a role they didn't like at all, but really has no choice because it thinks the family really needs it in this role. So basically, as I explored all this, I found, number one, that it's natural to have parts. They're not the product of trauma, which has been a way the field has thought about them, and that we're born with them, either manifest or dormant, and that they're all valuable. So it's natural to have all these little inner personalities that are in our lives to try and help us and have wonderful qualities and that can help us thrive. But traumas and what's called attachment injuries, you know, bad parenting, force them out of their naturally valuable states into roles that can be destructive and also freeze them in time. So many of these parts are living back when you got hurt as a child. They don't really even know that you're as old as you are. They think you're still 5 years old and you still are in that level of vulnerability. And they carry what I'm going to call burdens, which are extreme beliefs and emotions that came into you from some bad experience and attach to them almost like a virus, like the coronavirus, and drive the way they operate thereafter. So that's parts, but also very relevant to this discussion. As I was doing all that, and as a family therapist, I'm trying to have the parts have dialogues with each other, or have my client, like you, Alanis, have a dialogue maybe with your critic. Mm. And now that I know the critic isn't what it seems, I'm trying to get you to listen to it rather than argue with it or fight with it. Mm. And you're not doing that. You keep fighting with it. So I learned that means there's some other part that doesn't like the critic that's doing the talking. So I started to ask, could you find that one and ask it to just relax in there? Sort of like what we did in family therapy. When we have two people fighting and we want them to get along, they'll always pull in a third person and we'll jump in, and we learn to get that third person out, and then things calm down. So I started to ask clients to get these other parts to relax and open space. And then suddenly out of the blue, this other person popped out and knew how to relate to whatever target part we were working with in a way that was very healing, and would exhibit qualities like just pure curiosity and also calm and confidence relative to the part and compassion. It wasn't like they had to learn compassion. It was just inherent in this other person that popped out. And as I did that with other clients, it was like the same person would pop out with those same qualities and other what we call C-word qualities. And so now, almost 40 years later, thousands of people doing this all over the world, we can safely say that that, what I came to call self with a capital S, that essence in us is in everybody, can't be damaged, and knows how to heal, and knows how to relate to these parts in a healing way, but knows also how to relate to other people in a healing way. And that's actually the big deal about IFS, that discovery that just beneath the surface of these parts is this state we call self. And the degree to which you're embodied in self, in your body, along with the theme of this conference, is the degree to which yourself can lead. So embodiment is actually quite important that way, because parts have the ability to push what I'm calling self out of your body, which then, because it doesn't have access to your brain as much or to your organs, it's much harder. It doesn't have the traction it needs to actually lead as much. So helping parts trust it's safe to let you embody, which is difficult after you've been traumatized. The parts think that they have to protect self, even though they don't, and they make you more disembodied. So I'm cramming a lot into whatever little intro I've got here. And just
when you say taking care of the self, do you mean these protectors or these firefighters, as you call it in your model? Are they? They're ultimately attempting to take care of the vulnerable parts, and they
think they do that.
Capital self, or what? What's the the viewpoint?
They do that, but they also believe, for some reason, because it's not true, that yourself, what I'm calling self, is fragile and needs to be protected. So they will disembody that. And that's why some people watch themselves being traumatized. They're out of their bodies. Self mm-hmm. is your seat of consciousness. Mm-hmm. So, and trauma has the effect of making parts no longer trust the leadership of self.
Mm-hmm. If they did at all.
What?
If they did at all to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. But even more, because when you're a kid and you didn't protect the system, and some parts had to step up and take the bullet, then just like in a family, when a parent didn't protect the kids, they become what in family therapy is called parentified children. Mm. Well, these become parentified inner children. Now they've got to manage your whole life, even though they're young, and they're not equipped to do that. And that's partly why they become critics, because they're just yelling at you to try and get you to behave.
And the external manifestation then is, you know, having been parentified myself, there are so many times where I think the person who's in the driver's seat when I'm operating, I often mistake my capital S self for the parentified child trying to manage. Often I think that self, and that somehow capital S self could be beleaguered, which is not the case. So sometimes when I'm wondering who's in charge or who's in the symbolic front seat driving my car, a quick way for me to get a sense of that is if there's any unrest in my body, if there's tension, or if there's this tendency to want to control or manipulate or hide or, you know, do anything other than the C's that you described, the creativity, curious, courageous, I'd throw in super centered, calm. So if I'm not feeling these C's that you've described in your model, that's how I know that some part of me is in the driver's seat that is often white knuckling or terrified, or in my parentified example, I mean, just trying to act 46 when she's very much, like you said, frozen in the 6-year-old, you know, and then the havoc that can wreak on my body and on my well-being in general. I mean, for me, my husband and I talk about this at length about who, you know, when we're in the middle of a conflict, I'll just say, okay, who am I talking with right now? Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically like what part of us, especially if we get really conflictual and we don't see the window of repair looming in the distance, it's often that, you know, some 6-year-old part of me is just locked in with a 6-year-old part of him. And we realize that if we don't take some sort of break to bring down the cortisol or to get out of the slowly, gently out of the trigger or the flashback, and come back to the fact that there's a 46-year-old self in here, And that there is in my husband too. Mm-hmm. Also happens to be kind of sexy too, because, you know, mm-hmm. attempting to be, to have any kind of romantic chemistry with really, really young parts, just for me, the sexy part flies out the window when it comes to wanting to overly caretake. Not to say there's not incredibly large amounts of healing, you know, to be had in marriage. I think that's one of the best parts of marriage, is that we can be painted and ground into the hot kitchen corner and we kind of work our way out together. But yeah, for Solai, my husband and I, it's very much about, you know, who's talking right now. And a lot of you mentioned it briefly, and I've heard you say it before, Richard, the idea that there might be one part that comes forward, and as an example, it might be the part of me that is on the verge of a panic attack, just terrified. Mm-hmm. And then another part comes in and says, you know, hold it together. I'll call her the soldier, you know, hold it together. Your kids can't see you like this. Mm-hmm. And all these parts are inside. They're all really adorable and young and acting out in some ways. And then they fight with each other. And there's this sort of gridlock that happens inside. So when you notice your friends or clients or your own self having almost too many parts come into the football field, what's a great thing to do in that moment?
Well, you already kind of hinted at it, which also relates to the theme of embodiment. So like you're talking about with your husband, my wife Jean and I get into it, and self goes out the window. It's just it's parts wars, just these
parts wars, part 97. Okay.
And like you, we've learned, okay, time out. Let's separate. And we each go away. I come into this office.
Nice.
And I'll just take a second and I'll notice the parts that have been doing all the talking. And I'll listen to them. And they're so angry and they're so righteous. And she is really bad and wrong, right?
The problem,
and they can actually take over my eyes. So she looks a lot uglier than she is in those times.
It's just a veil. Yeah. The veil of acting out.
I just learned, you know, like you said, it's just this young kid trying its best to keep you safe. And her protector triggered this, what I call exile in me, which is a very vulnerable part that we try to stay away from, and is stuck in some, like you said, some trauma scene where my father yelled at me in a very similar way, for example. Mm. And so this part never is going to let that happen again. And no one can talk to me like that.
Yeah.
And so I just come in, I notice all this.
Yeah.
And I'll go to the protector and I'll say, I get it. And I really love you for trying to keep me safe. But listen, I can take care of this. I can handle it.
When you say I, you mean capital S self.
I mean capital S. I get separation is the first thing.
That disidentification, you know, Eckhart talked about it. I mean, so many people talk about it, the disidentification of the space between the part that's acting out or really attempting to get attention or shine light on something because, you know, I'm not listening or some, you know, so that part, and getting some distance to be able to actually dialogue with it.
Yeah. So I'll ask it to separate because they're very adept at blending and totally taking over your mind. So you only see through their perspective. So, but I've gotten good at knowing, okay, that protector's here. Would you please just let me talk to you and separate a little bit? And I'll say, thank you for trying. I know that what she said was hurtful to another part, but I'm not a little kid anymore. I'm actually, I don't want to say 71. And I can handle this. Just trust me. And so, and I'll also say, and I'm gonna, I need to do some more work with that part, that exile that she triggered, because clearly it hasn't been fixed. I'm still, some part's still stuck back there. And I'll follow up with that. But let me handle this. And so then I'll come back to Jean, and instead of speaking from these protectors, we speak for them. And I'll say some version of, you know, earlier, I said these things to you and it was coming from this protective part of me. And I was angry and I want to speak about that, but I didn't need to get like that. And I'm sorry I let that part take over. And I learned about what it was protecting. And it's this young part of me that was so shamed by my father. Mm. And you said something similar to what he would say. And so that's what was going on for me. And she would tell, you know, she would speak for her parts in a similar way. Mm. And especially once you speak for that vulnerable part, everything shifts. And
beautiful. And then if there is
much more in self.
If there were multiple ones, you would just continue the process of, mm-hmm. you know, semi-gently asking them to stand by or step aside.
Yeah.
In my experience, they do. They listen. For some reason, they listen when self is talking. When anyone else is talking, they're not that great at listening.
That's right. That's true. And they've learned to trust yourself, which is a process. It's one of the goals of our business.
Yeah.
Is to restore the trust they lost in you as a leader, to restore that back. And there are a variety of techniques to do that, but that's one of the big goals. And
is to be generally self-led versus letting any other part sit in the driver's seat.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay to let them take over once in a while. And sometimes it's fun to do that.
Like, give me an example of a fun one. Oh, you mean if you're, you know, the young part that just wants to run and.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, you get that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
But there are sexual parts of me that totally take over at times, and
yeah,
it's fun to let them, you know, let them out and romp around.
Mm-hmm.
So
in appropriate settings.
Appropriate setting, and not the young ones, like you said.
Right. Not the young parts. Yeah. Although the young parts, they have their own innocence and beauty, and they're in the midst of discovery. And to some degree, if we've been oriented or taught during our developmental time, I would assume that there's less burdens on these parts. The more nurturance during these stages of development, especially attachment, if there's more nurturance, more attention, more eye contact, more touch, more safety, my imagination would be that these parts would be less burdened and beleaguered and have less of a tendency of acting out. And you've said in a lot of your writings, Richard, that they then can be... They then can act from their highest purpose for being here, you know. So whether it's the inner artist or the inner activist or the inner, you know, the part of me that that is really fierce, you know, I like that there's a part of me that's fierce. I don't necessarily want to scare small children, but if I need to stand up for something or I need to have it infuse any kind of activism or show up for people, I'm so happy to be able to access this part. And it's because I actually love the angry part in me. I've had many conversations with her and cover of Rolling Stone saying that I indeed was an angry white female. And of course, that's just one part. Can you imagine? But because I love anger as an example, and I love the part of me that's angry, she's an ally. She becomes an ally. So it's almost like she's this awesome part of me that's like a pet. And if I go, sick 'em, she dives. But a lot of times she'll just stand by me almost like a child would in a way, this part.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you had the kind of parenting you described, then you're right. They all do their natural thing. And they all have these very clear talents and so on. And that's great. And you hardly notice them because they don't stand out because they're not burdened.
Right.
But
they don't act out.
If you don't, then they do carry these burdens and then they do get locked up and then you have to do a lot of healing. And the healing often involves not only having these dialogues with these protectors, but getting permission from them to go to these very vulnerable places where the exiles are stuck in the past and witness what happened and how bad it was. And because most of us, when we get hurt like that, want to get away from the memories, sensations, emotions, and beliefs. And we just move on. You know, this is a rugged individualist. Australia's
autonomous. Yeah. Such an autonomous movement that we're growing
out of. Don't look back. Just move on. It's all.
Don't need anything.
Don't need anything. You can't change the past. And so in moving on, we're leaving behind all these very vulnerable and before they got hurt, delightful, wonderful inner children who now, just because they got hurt, we abandon. And so we all have a bunch of those exiles that are hurting and we no longer have access to their energy, to their talents. And so that's the way most of us walk around.
And not unlike a therapist, I would imagine, in the room with a family, an actual family. It's really about kind of, I would imagine, just moving slowly toward, you know, being careful around where the hair's on fire, but at the same time being that sort of agencied capital S self that is really the trustworthy, because there were times where I would mistake the mom in me or the maternal matriarchal part as self. Mm-hmm. And I quickly realized, I think it was even in listening to you speak, I realized that it was actually the mom in me that I kept thinking was self. Mm-hmm. And so I kept thinking capital S self in me was also beleaguered, which sends my whole system into a little bit of a tailspin, because then there is no internal resource in that moment anyway. Of course, there are many internal resources that I've worked on through therapy and trauma recovery journey that I've been on for a while. But yeah, so entering with caution, depending upon how intensely wounded the exile is, or how intensely raging or acting out, I would imagine.
Yeah, and we don't do it without permission from the protectors too. So we would go to the angry part of you and say, okay, what are you afraid would happen if we went to what you protect? Because they'll usually tell you what they protect. And
during this time, I mean, maybe we could do one if you're up for it. I'll use myself as a case study. Right now, in postpartum, my first two postpartum experiences were very depression, immobilization, still attempting to function throughout it. This third time is actually high anxiety. And some of it is just at a different age, but I also think it's contextual and with what's happening in the mm-hmm. pandemic time and election time and, you know, third child. I mean, there's a million things going on, and then wanting to be of service in a macro way and trying to figure that out in these new times. So basically panic, like last night at 9:30 PM, I had a massive panic attack and I've had so many of them that I've now brought self to them. Mm-hmm. Because the first 1,000 times I thought what a panic attack, basically the message it sends is, oh, you're going to die. Mm-hmm. So all those symptoms, those physical symptoms of heart beating, clenched chest, my throat clenches, mind is racing. Also with PPD, there's a lot of invasive thoughts, you know, and so I'll ask you maybe if we could circle back to that in a minute. What's the difference between invasive thoughts and parts? And I'm imagining that invasive thoughts with postpartum activity, it's a part that is also trying to protect.
That's right.
It's a really challenging, I mean, you have to be pretty sophisticated in this work to recognize a picture or a vision, in my case, of people dying and skulls cracking and all these horrible images that are the invasive thoughts. That's the nature of what they are. And I'm assuming even biochemically, hormonally, neurobiologically, mm-hmm. it's this confluence, this coming together of this part to attempt to get a message to me in some way.
Exactly what it is.
And so, I mean, if you're up for it in real time, I'd be up for volunteering.
Let's do it.
I'm looking at that if you want to do it.
Sure. Yeah. You want to work with the panic
part? Yeah, the panic part. Okay. I love her, but there's a little mystery around it a bit.
Yeah. So, yeah. Go ahead and focus on her, focus on the panic experience, mm-hmm. and find it in your body or around your body, Lenz.
Mm-hmm. Want me to describe it when I find it?
Yeah, what do you find?
Yes?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, so immediately my heart started quickening, beating really quickly, sweat started to come, frontal cortex kind of went wonky a little bit. And by that, I mean, just kind of shut off. Mm-hmm. And then I feel this mobility in my body, like, okay, no, we don't have to have this conversation. Let's go somewhere. So that's another part.
Yeah, so let's ask that one to give us a little space to try and stay with the panic.
Okay.
And then as you notice the panic all through your body that way, mm-hmm. how do you feel toward that part?
How does my capital S self feel toward this panic part?
Yeah, how do you as self feel toward it?
Well, I can tell I'm not in self because I'm pretty ambivalent about her. Okay. So this must be the part that came to swoop in to join the party, who just really sees panic as an inconvenience when I'm I was literally breastfeeding my son while I was in the panic attack, trying to walk myself through it. You know, so a voice that goes, bad mom alert, you know, panic attacks don't fit my worldview of what a mom's supposed to be, you know. So that's another part I can ask them.
So let's ask that one to give us some space too, so we can really just help this panic part. We can't help it if you're got an attitude about it. So just ask that one who was shaming you for having it to just give us some space. And now, how do you feel toward it?
I actually have some love. I feel this warmth and this wave of warmth and sort of a movement toward, which is probably a little curiosity or just leaning toward.
So let's do that. Follow that movement.
Okay.
Let it know that you're interested in it, you're curious about it, and you love it, and see how it reacts.
She's got a little swagger. She's like, thank you.
That's great.
Yeah.
And just see what this part wants you to know about itself and why it gives you these panic attacks.
Yeah, the message I just got that she just said is that it's not random. Because I keep thinking panic attacks are random.
No, they're not random. But ask her then. Okay. If it's not random, huh? Ask her if it's not random, why is she doing it? What's it about?
If it's not random, why do you keep showing up at 9:30 p.m. every night? It's like clockwork, okay? She just said, I want you to stop.
Stop what?
Stop the activity, stop the over-functioning.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of still mired in work addiction recovery. It's an amazing lifelong journey for me. The overgiving, you know, the self-sacrifice, and some of that is natural, I think, in the first year of a baby's life. Right.
So does that make sense to you?
I mean, all of it makes sense. You mean that this panic part is really wanting to send me a message of slowing down and resting and stopping?
Yeah.
Yes, that makes perfect sense.
So let it know it makes sense. You get that? And see how it reacts to being heard.
Yeah, she's just kind of shifting around and kind of happy, wants to do her job, wants to keep imposing panic where she can, where it'll help. But she's also a lot happier than what her face is happier than it was even 5 minutes ago.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. She's being paid attention to.
So it sounds like she's wanting you to work with the other parts that keep you working and keep you giving to everybody and never stopping, never slowing down. And that she just wants you to have some peace.
Yes.
Let's make sure that's right. So just ask her if that's true.
Yeah. I got a big yes from her when you were saying it.
Okay.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. So tell her we're going to do a little with that. We got a little time still.
Okay.
So
yep.
Between the workaholic part and the caretaking part, which one would she like us to work with next?
Yeah, I think, I mean, in some ways, this part has both agendas going. So it's, I could call her the overgiving part, the overextended part.
Yep.
Chronically overextended, yeah.
So find her in your body or around your body?
I just see her all in my white knuckles and my, you know, the middle back pain in the back.
And as you see her, how do you feel toward her?
I'm grateful toward her. I have a lot of empathy toward that part too. It just seems wrung.
Yeah.
She's wrung.
So let her know you feel that way and see how she reacts to your gratitude and your empathy.
Big out breath.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
And maybe ask her what she's afraid would happen if she didn't do this all the time, if she didn't work so hard to take care of everybody and to please everybody. What's she afraid would happen? Okay. Just ask.
Yeah. She thinks everything would fall apart and everybody would die and there'd be no money and everyone would be living on the street and
yeah.
death.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not just my death, everyone's death.
So ask her how old she thinks you are. And just wait for the answer. Don't think of the answer.
She thinks I'm younger than her.
Yeah. How old is she?
Well, she's 7 trying to act 50.
Yeah. So maybe tell her how old you are now, that you're not a little kid anymore, and just see how she reacts.
Yeah, she kind of just give me the side eye. What I mean by that is she doesn't, she's leaning toward going, mm-hmm. She doesn't entirely trust.
So she's skeptical that you're that old, or she doesn't, is that right?
She's okay. Skeptical that I'm that old. She's also skeptical that I'm there.
That you're there at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she's felt like she had to run everything, mm-hmm. right? She didn't even know you hardly.
No. Okay. And for me, it was glimpsing self, capital S, for her, and all these parts were, I mean, there was a big turning point that, and I don't want to jump out of this because I'm feeling feelings and I don't want to run from it. It's a bit of a tendency of mine, but it's, okay, I'm not going to run then. I have so much to say, but that's another protector.
Yeah, let's ask that narrating part to give us space too.
The theorist. Yes. Okay.
And go back to her, because she needs your help. She really needs to get to know you.
Mm. Yeah, that parentified part. She's sort of shifting around in her seat, and I want to jump out of my body so badly. So just bringing.
You just ask that one to give us some space, a little more space.
The jumper.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The jumper. Okay.
This is a stretch for a lot of your parts to let you stay with these feelings. Just ask for a few more minutes.
Yeah. And I can, this physical sensation of this when I'm in, you know, what Fritz Perls would call the hot seat or, there's a lot of movement in my torso and chest all the way down to my pelvic floor here, mm-hmm. and my legs are hot and definitely sweating and some discharge happening, but I'm here. Self is here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we still want to stay with that caretaking part.
Okay.
The parentified part.
Mm-hmm.
And just, can you get back to her?
Yep, she's right here.
All right, and just see if there's more she wants you to know about herself.
She wants to enlist all these other parts of me to help her, not just self. So she wants capital S self to rally the inner troops so that she can take a break.
Yeah, so she's desperate for a break.
Desperate and also, you know, help. Desperate for help.
Yeah, that's right.
And so with my capital S self not helping her as consistently as could be the case, I externalize it a lot. I'll go, there's not enough help, you know, mm-hmm. there's not enough help out here.
Right, right.
Okay.
Okay, so ask what that would look like. If she could get a lot of help from you and from some other parts, what would that look like?
Yeah, I just had a big wave of empathy also going, so there's so many parts I can't access when I'm in postpartum. So I'm like, okay, I'll try and rally more. So another part clearly just swooped in, this grief-struck part that's like, I'm doing the best I can.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm not, I don't mean to you, I mean to her. She's saying that.
No, I get that. I got that. Sure. Okay. So let all these parts know everybody's stressed and everybody's overworked and that they don't really know you that well. So that's the project. But go back again to the
to her.
Mm-hmm. Maybe ask her this one. And in answering this, you don't have to tell you. You don't have to tell us what comes up, but ask her if she's stuck somewhere in the past and just see if she takes you someplace.
Let's see. There's a flurry. Yeah, she's little.
Okay.
She's trying to manage chaos.
Chaos in the house? Okay. So again, you don't have to give us any details about it, but tell her to really let you know what that was like for her. And just stay with it if you can, Alanis, if that's okay.
Totally. She's just so tired and so, it's, I picture a six-year-old girl trying to lead.
Yeah.
She's so just tired and sad, yeah.
Yeah, just stay with it. Just tell her you're really ready to get how tiring that was, how scary that was. And just stay with it.
My jaw is connected with her.
Yeah.
It wants to speak for her.
Okay. Go ahead.
I cracked my teeth. I read an article yesterday about people's teeth cracking and grinding and insomnia. And I was like, oh my God, I just had to have my tooth fixed because I've been grinding so much from this part, I think.
That's right. That's
cracked right. My tooth in half. Yeah. And so now I'm working on all this jaw work and her role is loosening even while we're talking. Good. But also in my life in general, she's starting to be invited to rest and she's a little bit unclear about how to do that.
Yeah, but before we stop, just ask her if she feels like you get how stressful that whole scene was when she was six. Ask if that's everything she wanted you to get or if there's anything else, anything more.
She just wanted to let me know that if I don't address this, that I might not live to 125 like I want to.
That's true. Mm-hmm. So, but does she feel like you get how bad that was, that scene? Just ask her.
Okay. Yeah, yes. She knows I see it. So,
mm-hmm. All right. So now I want you to go to her in that time period and be with her in the way she needed somebody. And just tell me when you're in there with her.
I'm sitting next to her on her childhood bed.
Okay, good. And what's it like for her to have you there?
She's quiet and sort of acting poised and perfectionistic and presentable like a good parentified child would.
So just let her know she doesn't have to do that with you. She can be real with you and that you're there to help her.
Yeah, she's a little armored right now and she kind of gives a little glimpse once in a while, but she's not giving.
Yeah.
Eye contact.
We're just going to hang out there with her until she does trust that she can be herself with you. So just keep, in whatever way feels right, you know how to do this with her. Just let her know you're safe. She doesn't have to pretend.
Yeah, she's curious what I want, what self wants.
Yeah, so you can tell her what you want, but just also let her know that you're there to help her deal with all this. And just ask if she wants you to do something in the house for her.
Yeah, she just wants to go for a walk.
All right. So let's do that. Get her out of the house.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah, the thing about parentification too, it's like the popsicle time where you just go get a popsicle on your bike. She's yearning for that fun and that simplicity. And
yeah. So go ahead and do that with her.
Yeah, one of my resources is sun and ocean and nature. So we're walking together in that setting in my mind's eye.
Yeah, good. And let her know she can just stay with you this way. She doesn't have to go back there if she doesn't want to. And you can take care of her. She doesn't have to take care of you or anybody else.
Wow, so capital S self can go back and kind of tend to what she was burdened by or carrying, or her multiple agenda around trying to manage. And
yeah, I mean, you can do that, but she doesn't have to live back there.
She doesn't have to come with me. Yeah, or does she? Is it ideal for them to be near self, sort of witnessing the self acting on their behalf, or
it's totally up to the part. Some parts really want that, and some parts just want to get out of there.
I think this part wants to just see.
Yeah, just ask to be sure.
Yeah, she's okay with stepping away.
All right, so let's take her wherever she wants to go. And could be the present, could be in nature, could be a fantasy place, whatever she'd like.
Yeah, it's cross-country skiing.
Okay. Fantastic. It was
pure joy as a child, yeah.
With you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So again, just let her know you're going to be taking care of her now. She's not going to have to live back there. And see how she reacts to that idea.
She smiles.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
And given that, see if she's interested in unloading the feelings and beliefs she got back there that she's been carrying all this time.
Yes, she's desperate to, because she actually cares about this system. She wants me to live longer.
Okay. All right. And ask where she carries all that in her body and on her body.
Where she carries all that, meaning her burden?
The emotions and beliefs she got back there.
excuse me. Yeah, it's it's jaw, it's neck.
Yeah.
The usual suspects of stress carrying.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's a lot of armor.
All the fear and all the responsibility, all that.
Yeah, it's so flooding. It's like, ooh.
Ask what you'd like to give it all up to. Light, water, fire, wind, earth, anything else.
I think water.
So set that up for her, Alanis. Just however that should happen, just let all that go out of her body into the water till it's all out.
Yeah, she looks really pretty.
That's great. How's she doing?
She's good. She's psyched to be here, sitting, watching the water.
Okay, good. And tell her she'd like to now. She can invite qualities into her body, whatever she'd like. And you can just see what comes into her.
Qualities into her body?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, this whimsy. Mm-hmm. she's a great leader and boss, sort of archetypally, innate kind of archetypal fun leadership, like inspirational leadership. She'd rather just lead in a kind of unfettered way than this kind of, you know, cumbersome, burdened way.
Yeah, so let her know you get that she's a natural leader and that she can be that inside of you.
Right, I'm not taking that away from her. Yeah,
not taking that away from her, but she can do it in a totally different way without all that tension.
Right.
And how's that for her?
It's great. It's so merciful. It feels, she's breathing.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and she has a little smile, like a kind of soft smile.
Okay. So before we stop, let's bring in that panic part to see her and to see how different she is. And just see how the panic part reacts.
Oh, yeah, the panic part also is very associated with her, because the panic part is the part that has always known that a young person can't be an adult.
That's right. Yeah. So how's the panic part?
She's been freaked out thinking that children were in charge.
How's the panic part reacting now?
She's just playing with something on her desk.
Right. Okay. And then before we stop, maybe just check your body now. How's your body feeling compared to when we started?
So it's a lot warmer in certain areas. There's still a clench just from, you know, there's a part sneaks in and goes, I just want to make sure we do well by everyone watching.
Right.
So just don't worry for a second. The panicked part, can you help me a little bit more with, can you bring me back from having been dissociated for 10 seconds there?
Yeah, sure. We can just, this feels fairly complete right now. So
yeah,
you want to come back
out? So your question really was how is her body? That was the question, right? So
that was more, how is your body now?
How is my body?
How's your body now that we've done this work with these parts? Given this is an embodiment conference.
A lot more grounded. And by that, I mean, I feel actually heavier and warmer. I'm getting sensation back in my fingertips. They were a little tingly while we were doing that. And just really grateful for your facilitation too. These parts really love you.
Well, my parts really love you too. And I'm so grateful to you for taking this risk and
it's just feelings. Always tell my children, I'm like, it's just crying. Crying's the best. All these stigmatized feelings, right? The crying and the, for me, it was, you can't be angry, which is funny. Can't be sad and can't be afraid. So of course I'm like angry white female with massive panic attack stuff. Just freaking terrified. And So those are the three top ones, those parts that were really lost, hidden, denied, to speak in Harville Hendrick's terms. It's the sadness, the terror. So there's a lot of counterphobia in my life. Like someone says, who wants to scale the mountain? And I'm my hands up before I'm like, how did that hand get up volunteering once again? You know, so there's this counterphobia. That was her way of acting out with the panic too, is because she felt lonely in there. It's like, oh, I'm just going to pretend to be the opposite, which is probably another part, right? The
unknown part, needs, yeah.
Fearless part comes in to try and help her.
That's exactly right.
It's so
right.
Wild.
Yeah.
Wow.
Good. So how are you feeling?
Thank you. Excited. I love deconstructing things. So there's a tendency for me to quickly want to go, okay, so what happened there? Which of course we can do, but I feel.
Hopefully there is a video of this so you could watch.
Watch my own video of this?
Yeah.
Okay. It's really useful. I'll have to talk to the part that doesn't like watching videos of my own self. But this muscle of turning toward that which we think has been the reason why we've dissociated or frozen or fought or collapsed.
Mm-hmm. It's totally counterintuitive from our culture. But,
and yet when I'm sitting in what we're calling capital S self, mm-hmm. this a moment ago when you said that the C's, the compassion, these aren't, it's not something I'm manipulating though, the curiosity and the leaning toward the self. Mm-hmm. And because we live in a culture that has a tendency toward super normalization of narcissism and mm-hmm. lack of empathy, mm-hmm. There's this erroneous thought, I think, that's swimming around, and I believe you may have mentioned this as well, that we have to teach empathy and we have to teach mm-hmm. curiosity and we have to teach these qualities, and they're so innate.
Totally innate.
Using your language, when there is an unburdening happening or when self is really in this driver's seat.
That's right.
It's such natural curiosity and willingness. And I mean, there's, you know, the part of me that stigmatizes everything in here, right. You know, she's another story, but there is, it really welcomes pure presence and holding space for what shows up and not needing to know the answer, like living in that question mark in a felt sense way, you know, like we're all living in this massive question mark right now.
It was striking when we were starting to get to know the panic and you had attitude about it and, you know, as naturally you would. And we had to get a couple parts to step back, and suddenly, and you even sat forward, you mm-hmm. said, I love it. And I really want to get to know it. I have curiosity about it. It was so apparent. You were totally in self immediately. Mm. And that is what we're talking about, that's just there. It's covered over by a lot of these parts.
Yes. And I love using that sun metaphor, that the self is the sun, and or the ocean metaphor, then the clouds are the parts. Or I also like the one of, you know, the waves on the top part of the ocean, but the isness or the suchness or the self is that still silent, unmovable place underneath. And one of the biggest parts of the parts work for me was for a long time, you know, I'm such a young woman and parts woman, shadow process, Debbie Ford woman. So one big turning point for me was I was in New York, and I remember thinking, I've spent all this time embracing the dark parts and the light parts and the murderous rage and the joy and the, you know, the love and the light and all these parts back and forth. And I would feel that my inner work process, whether it took 1 minute or whether it took an hour, I would feel it was incomplete until I looked at both sides, the mm-hmm. tall and the short of it all. Mm-hmm. And the one turning point I had was that I kept trying to find this part of innate badness, right? Because the planet, religion, everything says that we're innately sinners, we're innately bad. So in being the conscientious wholeness worker that I liken myself to be, I could find, you know, the opposites and the turnaround, for lack of a better term, the Byron Katie term of, if I'm looking at anger part, I want to look at the part before I'm done the process. I like to look at the super joyful part. So in this inquiry, I kept trying to find the innate bad part of me. You know, I was like, I think there's going to be some good stuff from her, you know, mm-hmm. and I could never find her. And a therapist, just a moment of silence for therapy and how life-saving it is. My therapist said, well, sweetheart, I think you're not going to find it because it's the only thing not subject to dualism, your innate goodness, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just was, it was a huge turning point for me. I remember walking around the streets of New York, weeping, trying to hide my face from people walking by because I just couldn't believe that there was no that, because I've always believed, you know, innately, that we are innately good, no matter how much we act out, no matter how much narcissism or dictatorialism, or, you know, whatever we're in that is tragic and horrifying for the human spirit, that underneath all of these parts that are acting out to get our attention, desperately acting out sometimes, that there is no way to locate this bad self because it's not there. It doesn't exist. Right. And for me, that was a really big turning point. And it was so in keeping, it answered a lot of questions because this dualism is so fascinating to me. We live in a dualistic realm, this sort of playground of wildness and multiple colors and multiple parts. And attempting to find this bad part just wasn't even possible for me. And I now realize it's because it's not there.
It's not there.
It doesn't mean I don't behave in ways that don't hurt people or have massive blind spots, but that innate badness that we're taught that we are, unfindable.
That's right. There aren't any bad parts and all parts are welcome.
And your new book is called No Bad Parts, right?
Right, exactly.
So good.
Yeah. And I know Stephanie's coming in because we need to do the Q&A, I think, right?
Oh, well, you can keep talking. I really appreciate your session. It was really lovely. I mean, I can't say how many people were touched by the work you've done so far. Yeah, we have a few questions. So would you like me to ask them or would you want to read them? It's up to you.
Asking them. You okay with
that? Yeah, sure. So the first one is, what's the difference between a normal internal system and dissociated identities? Can that rift be negotiated with?
Yeah, so people with dissociative identity disorder that used to be called multiple personality disorder aren't any different than me and Atlantis and Stephanie, except that because they were horribly, horribly abused, often ritually abused as kids, their system got blown apart more. So their parts are much more separated from each other and more burdened, more extreme. And the self is there, but their perpetrators often would torture them more whenever they saw these C-word qualities. And so their parts came to really fear self. And that's how people get brainwashed, because if you don't have self in your body, then you can pump in whatever you want. So generally, with that population, I've worked with a number of those clients successfully, and I'm become the self of the system initially. So I'm talking to each part directly in this compassionate way, helping them get to know each other, because often they don't know each other at all. And then ultimately talking them into opening space for self to come out and start to do the work. That's the only difference. The full range personalities that are called alters in that population are no different from what I'm calling parts.
Great. The next question is again for Richard. Could you speak to why self-energy is not available to children to protect them in traumatic situations, and therefore protective parts have to step up, and yet self is always there for us if we can rebuild a trusting relationship with it as adults?
Because children don't have the body. It's not about not having enough self. It's about having not enough muscles and enough of a brain to actually protect. And that's, you know, a lot of times, like when Alanis went to that, was it a 6-year-old or 5-year-old?
6-year-old.
Sometimes that part, we have to have a big repair, and Alanis might spontaneously say, I'm so sorry I couldn't protect you. I just didn't have the body to do it. So that's the reason.
Yeah, so it's what you're saying, if I'm hearing it correctly, is that the self is always there, the soul. I mean, if someone uses the word soul or God within, I mean, it sounds like those are beautifully interchangeable. That is the one permanent, and that is that is what's ceaseless. And then, you know, when we think of people who people call evil, you know, a lot of conversations about evil, whether it's, you know, fascism or dictatorialism, or is it what you just said? I mean, I'm kind of semi-rhetorically speaking about this, but it's that the parts are so burdened that their actings out are so extreme to the point where, I mean, you and I had this conversation a couple of years ago where, you know, where I said, there are some people who are struggling with narcissistic personality disorder or extreme sociopathy or even psychopathic. These people, to me, I don't even know where I would begin in having a conversation with them because of the fact that there are certain parts that are so shut down or acting out so wildly to the point of murdering people and starting wars and perpetuating wars. And so, I mean, I'm assuming these people aren't the first in line to sit across from you, Richard. And you know, is our understanding of the acting out of these parts of us, is our understanding enough when we have people in positions of leadership who are, you know, stuck in these parts, and my guess and projection is that they're not necessarily reaching out for help? What can we do as a society when we notice these parts in other people that are in so much pain? I mean, you know, within our political system, within our, you know, in all the systems, really. I mean, short of that person asking for help, you know, is it just holding space or setting really, really, really amazing boundaries? And then there are some you can't really set a boundary with if they're acting out in a really extreme way. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, if you want to mention names and talk about our president, the president we share here in the United States, when I see him, I see his protectors, and his protectors are going crazy because it looks like he's going to lose. And he's got a part that just can't stand that idea of being a loser because of his father and so on. Mm-hmm. And he's just got a lot of exiles. He's got a lot, you know, you see the part that's so empty and so
hungry,
so worthless that it constantly has to get these rallies and accolades, or he's going to get depressed, or, and so when you see somebody that way, you don't just see their protectors. You can see, it's like you have X-ray vision. You can see their exiles too. You can have compassion even for him when he's ruining it, while he's ruining our country, but you also feel compelled to get him to stop him.
Right.
So that social activist, I work a lot now with social activists, and a lot of it is about doing the activism from self, where you don't demonize the other person because you see the pain that's driving their damaging protectors. At the same time, you're acting to stop them.
Right. You may not. I mean, for me, it's just the parts of me that are, or, you know, the self, truly just looking at certain people where I can have empathy for them, but I don't want them leading me. I don't want to follow them into a towering inferno.
Yeah.
You know? So really it's empathy combined with a boundary that you set in the form of voting, or in the form of, you know, whatever boundary. It could also include just cutting all contact if it's even possible, or just certain boundaries that you have to set with parts that continue to act out with no real willingness for them to do the work or to look at these parts or connect with them in any way.
That's right. And if you're having trouble doing that, then you go to the parts that are afraid to have boundaries, the parts that are that still feel very attached to this narcissistic person, and see what that's about. And usually they're stuck in some place in the past too.
Perfect. Next question is, how do you hone your rage as an ally in your creative process and expression? I guess it's for Alanis.
I just see anger as this incredible current part. And I think two of the parts in me that really move worlds are love and anger. So a lot of times I used to think that I could get away with writing songs and not having to deal with humans. And that somehow that process of writing these songs and performing them would be healing. But I quickly came to see, after singing a song called You Ought to Know very many times around the planet, that it was cathartic, and there was some movement of energy, and there's this current racing through me. And when I'm done the shows, I feel very spent in the best of ways. But I did notice that there wasn't any full-blown corrective experience. There wasn't any repair as such. And as soon as relationality comes into play, you know, there's some conversations we had about art therapy. Part of what makes it so magical is that, and potentially healing versus just cathartic, is the sharing of the art, is the witnessing of it, is the relationality of it. It's doing it with a human being. So my goal in life was to take how I could communicate so articulately and so clearly in a song that's 3 minutes long, how I could take that into my life and bring that quality and actually risk talking with other humans and trusting and recreating what safety means for me and almost starting from scratch in that way. But my point is just that the process of creating art is very, very therapeutic and cathartic for me, but enter relationship is where the deep healing happens, where I can be this artist or perform this song or have this conversation or feel these feelings in the face of a non-judgmental, often wise listener.
Perfect. Then there's a question about anger as well, but it would be for Richard. Can self be angry? Alanis said she has the angry part. So I am wondering, is self just consciousness and every other emotion is other part?
No, I mean, what I said earlier about these eight C words. So it includes compassion and clarity and confidence and so on. And so the self has those emotions and others. Does self get angry? It depends on your definition of angry. For me, anger often involves judgment of the other as bad. And self doesn't ever feel that way because of the things I was saying earlier. Because self can see the pain that drives the enemy, even if the enemy is doing terrible things. So in that sense, self doesn't get angry. But self can be very forceful. Self can act in a very forceful way to stop somebody if they're doing damage. So it depends on your definition.
Another question, how do you deal with shame when you feel like you've screwed up? How do you metabolize it instead of turning it into self-punishment or self-criticism?
You want to start, Alanis?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's realizing the physical sensation of shame. You know, I have this poster on my wall that someone painted of bodies and where the warmth and the heat and the cold in their experience shows up in anyone's body. And I had the shame section is just this really hot heat, red in the chest. And so your question was about how to work with shame and how to transmute that. Is that what your question was? Okay. Well, for me, shame is also something incredible to write about. Also just seeing where there's, I know Pia Melody over the years has said healthy shame versus unhealthy shame. I think healthy shame is it's really social and relational. Like, it's almost like an impetus to take responsibility for something. It's in that category of guilt. Guilt is being out of integrity with what I say my value system is. Shame is just a human emotion. And, you know, I see my sweet puppies have this sort of shame experience. And if I'm sitting across from someone who loves me, it can turn into a laugh or a giggle. But the shame, if I can disidentify from it and have a dialogue with it, if it's, what Pia calls unhealthy shame. Unhealthy shame is a part. You know, and then healthy shame is an experience that I have that kind of moves through me. I see it in my children too. It's what often leads them to come and say a quick sorry or do a quick repair. If we didn't have guilt and shame, there'd be no physical sense of who to apologize to or what to take responsibility for or where to, you know, what kind of work to do internally.
So I'll jump in a little. So for me, unhealthy shame is an oxymoron because again, it depends on your definition of shame. Yeah. But for me, shame always implies some sense of badness. Mm. And self never feels that. But right. Self does feel compassion. So if I hurt somebody, then and I'm in self, then I'll see that. Or if one of my parts hurt somebody, and then myself will see that I need to make a repair and will be able to do that. But But for me, shame is often at least two part phenomena. So there's a part that feels like you're worthless, and that's usually an exile. It's a young part that just feels like you have no value, you're unredeemable, and you're just bad. And it got that from bad parenting or trauma. And then there's a part that says that about you all the time. So that would be the critic that is calling you those names all the time to get you to try and control you in the way we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm working with shame, I'm going to start with that critic, and I'm going to go through some of the steps we went through about what are you afraid would happen if you didn't make her feel so bad constantly. And then we would learn about the one it's trying to protect who feels so worthless. And it's trying to protect that one by keeping her small and invisible and not having her show herself so she doesn't get more worthlessness and fail. Mm-hmm. So that's ultimately what we learn about it. Then we get permission to go to the one the young one who feels so worthless. And then we go through those healing steps that you went through today and get her out of where she's stuck in the past and unload all the shame. And now she's a lighthearted, happy little kid who doesn't need to be protected that way.
So no such thing as healthy shame. What would be another way of naming that phenomenon? What would be another way of naming it's a part, you know, it's basically the positive opposite of shame, you know, shameless behavior.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of.
Would be compassionate behavior.
It's compassion, right? So healthy shame, I think it might, sounds like it's, might be more accurate to call it, I don't know, what's the opposite of shameless? Is it compassion?
Yeah.
Okay.
Compassion, responsibility, action, you know, taking action.
Awesome.
Yeah. Great. Now there's another question. I know, Richard, people used to ask this question many times to you, but I will ask. Have you worked with people with abusive behavior? And what is their array of parts like? I assume it's protectors, firefighters, but I have a hard time understanding why a person or a part would act in a way that seems to be intended to destroy another person and or destroy any possibility of empathic connection.
Yeah, I have, you know, Alanis talked about murderers and sociopaths and so on, and I've worked with that population. I consulted to a treatment center for sex offenders for 7 years, and worked with a lot of people that fit those profiles, and you know, came in with my own attitudes about them and had to do a lot of work on myself. But when I could get just purely curious about the part that did the abusing or the murdering, worked with some murderers too, and we heard its secret history, we learned its story of how it got forced into that role. The common thread was at some point in that, these were men, so at some point in that boy's life, when he was being abused somehow, that part stood in front of the others and protected everybody else, took the hit from the abuser, and was so desperate and felt so powerless that looked around the room and said, "Who has power in this room? It's this guy who's doing this to me," and took on that guy's energy to try and protect the system from the guy. Do you follow all that?
And there, so what did that look like? What did that look like? What was the behavior that you would visually witness when that was happening?
I'm not sure what you're asking. It was an abuse scene.
Okay, so are they literally saying the power is in this person in this room, and this is unconscious, I'm imagining, right?
Yeah. I mean, the person isn't consciously doing that, but the part mm-hmm. who was protecting, who was a hero in a way, mm-hmm. because he did take the bullet, says, "I'm going to take on this guy's energy because it's powerful, because I can then protect myself from him. And I can protect myself in general." And then he's got all these other parts that are still stuck in the powerlessness of that abuse that are constantly wanting something powerful. And so this part gets a big rush out of being powerful and actually punishing vulnerability, and will punish their own vulnerability. I mean, Trump has that part in spades. He hates vulnerability. He hates anything that's weak, anything that's sick even. You saw that when he went in the hospital.
Yeah.
And so he got that. It's a legacy burden, what we call a legacy burden. He probably got that from his father, who got that from his father. And it just kind of trickles down the generations. And, you know, along these lines, Trump's older brother drank himself to death because he was such a failure, because his father, he wouldn't go into the father's business, and the father just berated him. And Trump watched that happen and took on the father's energy to protect himself from the father. And that's how these legacy burdens get transferred over the generations. So when we get to that part, we do the, you know, I did an updating thing where I had you ask the part how old it thought you were, and it still thought you were very young. And we do the updating. Oh, I don't need this legacy burden. I don't need to carry this anymore, because I'm not in that vulnerable, powerless situation. And we can actually just send it out.
Yeah. And the definition of power too is so in need, in my opinion, of being updated too, because there's the personal power, which basically being in capital S self is about as empowered as I feel I could possibly get. And then there's the worldly power. And in school and in general, it's very much taught that power has one definition. You either have power or you don't. And it makes sense that if we're abused, that we look to see who has the power in the room, and we associate and maybe identify and mimic in a way and keep that legacy going. But to point out that it's not really actually power. There might be worldly power, but worldly power itself comes and goes. It's usually based on money and influence. That comes and goes. Those are waves. But the personal power, the returning to the capital S self, is the power that I'm interested in, because that doesn't really, that's not subject to the vicissitudes of how life ebbs and flows all around us in terms of our perception of how much power we have in the world, you know? So just to render those a little distinct, I think, has been really helpful too.
Yeah, and that's not power over, you know, that's just the power to be in life, be in this world.
Grow up.
Well, thank you very much, Richard and Alan. It's last question, because we've got some practitioners in the house. What book should we start with if we want to learn more? Richard has written so many.
Okay. the manual for therapists is called Internal Family Systems Therapy, Second Edition, which I put out this year, actually. And it's published by Guilford Press. So that's where I would start. For the public, off our website, we sell a book that, oddly enough, is called Introduction to Internal Family Systems. And so that's written for lay people. And so those are the two places I would start.
Perfect. Anything you would like to add that we've been missing, maybe?
Go ahead, Alanis.
Right now, no. So much more to talk about. And I feel as though I could have a conversation with you and with everyone about this for days. I'm thinking about the Internal Family Systems books, and then the Debbie Ford books, Dark Side of the Light Chaser, was a powerful book in terms of even getting to know the idea of having multitudinous parts within. And then, you know, Jung all the way back to sub-personalities and aspects of self. So, but why I love IFS so much is that it includes everything that I have loved about parts, and really the process that you led me through, Richard, and the process that IFS extends and invites people to dive into is so comprehensive and gentle. And it has fueled so much liberation in my body. So I'm really grateful to you for that.
You're very, very welcome. And I'm so honored that you're such a supporter. Mm-hmm. And in terms of final things, I guess what I would want to say is people can do a lot of this on their own. There's a way to just instead of thinking this of this as a sensation in my body, or you know, a sort of random thought or an extreme emotion, to just start to separate, and mindfulness is good at that. So anybody who does mindfulness practice automatically starts to separate from their parts. And then on your own, you just start getting curious. But to do that, you often have to get the parts that are polarized with this one to step back. So wait until you are genuinely curious to start the process. But there's so much that you can do on your own. And then it becomes a kind of life practice where, you know, before I sat down to do this call today, I noticed the parts that were up, and, you know, especially when I heard how many people are going to see this. And I did, and I just said, okay, I get you guys are worried about this, but just for an hour and a half, give me some space. Let me be present. And then through the whole time, I'm noticing, is my heart still open? How's my breathing? Do I have a big agenda? I'm noticing if parts are there, and I'm so grateful to them because they really stayed out of this. And I was able to be most of the time, there were a few times, but most of the time I was able to lead from self. And the point I'm trying to make is it's really, really possible to do this on your own, a lot of it. So